Hey, moneymakers, welcome back to another live edition of Taking Stock. I'm Kalila Reynolds, and we're bringing you all the latest business news and telling you how it will affect you and your money. Whew! Okay, the budget debates are finally over, and there's so much that we still need to talk about. So tonight's show will be a good one. In the meantime, don't forget to hit the like button and subscribe to the channel. Let me know in the comments where you're joining us from. Here's a look at what's coming up in tonight's show, followed by what's hot in business. And come on, let's get this money.
The government has laid out its plan for this year's $1.3 trillion budget, but Jamaicans still have lingering questions. Finance Minister Dr. Nigel Clark will join us live to discuss the national budget, and the analysts weigh in on the latest market developments. First Caribbean is ramping up its expansion plans across Jamaica and the region. Plus, Guyana just made its first oil discovery for 2024. How is the country's economy faring? We'll discuss. But first, here's what's hot, brought to you by JMMB Group, your best interest at heart. The grand opening of the first Juicy Patties location in the United States was a massive success, the company says. The restaurant, located in Hollywood, Florida, officially opened last week and is part of the Popular Eateries plan to expand into the U.S. market. According to the company, the launch was such a success that the new outlet was forced to close on Sunday for restocking, as customers bought 5 days' worth of patties in one day. General insurance company Iron Rock Insurance says personal data for some of its clients were leaked on the dark web. According to the company, it became aware of a data breach on March 14 and immediately took steps to contain the hack. The company said it regained full control of its IT network within an hour of the breach being detected. However, Iron Rock revealed that the names and addresses of a limited number of clients from 4 years were leaked. Iron Rock said the breach had no material impact on its core operations. Tourism Minister Edmund Bartlett says Jamaica earned $1 billion from tourism in the first 2 months of the year. The minister revealed that the island welcomed over 1 million visitors in January and February, a 15% increase compared with last year. Since the pandemic, Bartlett said the ministry has used 2019 for its benchmark for growth. However, after welcoming over 1 million visitors and earning more than $4 billion, the ministry now considers 2023 to be the benchmark. What's Hot was brought to you by JMMB Group, your best interest at heart.
I mean, how much do you need? I can help you out. You know, I've got your back all the time. Right? Here you go. You need some gas money too? What else do you need? You need rent? Here you go. Here you go. Here you go. Take 5, 10. Just take it all. Take it all. So, excuse me. So, I had the... Oh, no, here it is. Why you better come? Why you bother come? And you order the most food too? Excuse me, miss. Sweetie, I'm sure there's a way out of this. Like, all you need is a job. Waiter, do you have any dishes that she could wash? Babe, hush. This isn't you. Right? We're gonna get your life back on track. We're gonna sort out your finances. Take my masterclass and we'll figure all of this out, right? Let's get this money. Welcome back. Let me just ask, which friend are you? Are you the investing friend, the broke friend, the friend that got your friends back? Just let me know in the comments. Let me see who we have online so far. We got Patricia, Jamaican in Bermuda. We got Roger in Philly. Kish saying hello, moneymakers. Sean saying good night to the future millionaires. Sean said, hope Kalila starts on time today or else she's getting a red card. Taking a note from Minister Nigel Clark's presentation today. Well, he is on. He's backstage ready to join us. Raquel says, good night, Antoinette, joining from Arizona. We have NanoSense joining from far, far away. We got Jermaine all the way in China. So a lot of people waiting patiently for tonight's presentation. Over the past 3 weeks, we've heard the government and the opposition go back and forth over Jamaica's $1.3 trillion budget. A lot of good points were made on both sides, but we, the public, still have some questions. So joining me now to discuss the 2024-25 national budget is Finance Minister Dr. Nigel Clark. Welcome back to the show, Dr. Clark.
Thank you, Kalila. Thank you for having me. Pleasure to be with you.
Glad to have you as well. You must be tired because it's been a marathon day and few weeks.
Yes, it always is. You know, you have to prepare the budget presentation, and then, you know, the finance minister is the only person who speaks twice. I have to speak again. And in speaking again, I have to, you know, summarize, but at the same time respond to comments, claims, suggestions that have been made. So it is definitely, it takes a toll.
How do you do it? Because I was thinking, you spoke for 4.5 hours the first time. The PM spoke for 5 hours. I know when I give presentations, my voice goes out after 2 hours. And you maintain the energy, like how?
You know, if I think about it, I can't explain it myself. If I really kind of think about it. But, you know, it's just passion. I'm very passionate about Jamaica. I've always been from I've been a child, and I believe fervently that Jamaica is a country of destiny, and we have been underperforming for, you know, 50 years, all of my lifetime. And I'm just passionate about the opportunity to, you know, take our country forward in a direction or help to take our country forward in a way that we haven't had the opportunity before. So it's that passion that keeps me going, and, you know, we're getting results at the same time. And so, you know, the results are self-reinforcing, if you understand what I mean. They propel you forward. So, you know, it's like you're prepared to, you know, take the obstacle course, the energy that's required, the, you know, the beat up, the criticism, sometimes unfairly, because you are convinced that, you know, you're doing something and making a contribution that needs to be made.
Mm-hmm. So I sure have some questions for you, but tonight I really want it to be about the viewers and hearing feedback from the public. What questions do you guys, our viewers, still have for Minister Clark, having heard his opening debate, his closing debate, and all the debates in between the PM, the opposition leader, the finance spokesperson on opposition? Put your comments in the chat. We'd love to hear what your questions are. But while they get theirs together, I'm going to start the ball rolling. One of my questions, Dr. Clark, was on the issue of the securitization of receivables, because everybody always asks, okay, you're going to do all this stuff. How are you going to pay for it? You made this announcement that there's going to be what we call securitization of receivables. Basically, the government is selling $45 billion of receivables in order to offset expenses in the budget. But then the opposition leader pointed out that you said it was market sensitive, so you couldn't reveal what it was. What can you tell us at this point?
Well, so, Kalila, there is nothing abnormal about that. The budget consists of $300 billion of market financing, right? Of loan financing. We are not required, nor do we specify exactly how we're going to do that, because that would be market sensitive information. So we don't come out and say we're going to issue a bond of 10 years duration in June, or nor do we say we're going to issue a J dollar instrument internationally or issue a J dollars of this. No, we just put forward that we're going to finance the budget by raising, I'm sorry, the number this year is $200 billion in new financing. We are paying off $300 billion of maturing debt, and we are engaged in borrowing of $200 billion of new debt. So we don't provide, you know, particulars on that, because to provide particulars on the debt that we'll be issuing would influence what is possible. And we don't want to do that. That's not in the public's interest. And similarly, what I described as the sale of receivables is non-recourse financing, meaning that it's financing that the government of Jamaica, it's not debt, the government of Jamaica doesn't have to pay it back. But to say any more at this point could jeopardize the transaction. So it's not in the public interest to do so. At the right time, I will provide complete details, and I'll be back on your program, if you invite me, to provide details on that transaction. But to do so in advance would be to put the transaction at risk, and nobody wants that to happen.
So that means that it hasn't been sold. You don't have a buyer yet. It's just a plan to sell the receivables at this point.
No, we have, you know, we have market testing, and we have, you know, so let I don't want to say too much on it, Kalila. Let me, at the right time, which, you know, hopefully won't be, we have 12 months, right? But at the right time, which hopefully won't be too long, you know, I'll be back on your program. And like I always do, I'll provide all the information at a time that I'm able to do it. I'm just not able to do it now because it would affect the very transaction that we want to see happen. And again, I gave you the parallel with loan financing that we have put out, that we are going to be borrowing $200 billion issuing $200 billion of new debt this year and paying off $300 billion of maturing debt. But we are not providing any particulars about the tenure of that debt, the rates that we are going to be seeking, the currencies, when we're going to do it, or anything like that, because that would undermine the very transactions. So what my posture here is very consistent. And I know that you want to know more, but I commit to you that once you make the invitation, I'll be back on your program to discuss that transaction when I'm in a position to do so.
Well, I'll definitely be making that invitation. I see some questions starting to come in from the audience. So let's take the first one from our audience. Javon wants you to shed some light on the unemployment. Well, he has two questions, and it's two long questions. Unemployment insurance, tax credit. Let's take them one at a time. So yeah, unemployment insurance.
I am inspired by the interest in unemployment insurance. You know, it's nice to work on a juicy piece of policy and to find that the public is interested in that policy. Unemployment insurance, I don't know what direction the questioner wants me to go, but let me just say that unemployment insurance has been a reality for other Caribbean countries for decades, Bahamas and Barbados. Jamaica started the national insurance scheme in the 1960s. And in that debate, when you look at it, the intention was to, you know, do unemployment insurance next, but history took over, so to speak. The unemployment insurance scheme is a contributory scheme in the worst case, and will provide an unemployment benefit that is linked to the person's prior earnings. So I give an example of Barbados and Bahamas to make the point. In Barbados, a person who is newly unemployed will receive 60% of their previous weekly earnings for 26 weeks, that is 6 months. In Bahamas, the person who is newly unemployed will receive 50% of their previous weekly earnings for 13 weeks, which is 3 months. Jamaica will have to choose the parameters that make sense for us. The cost from our feasibility study is about 0.8% to 1.5% of payroll if we simply slap it on as an additional deduction. We would ideally not like to do that. What we'd prefer to do is to consolidate existing deductions into a single social statutory tax or whatever you know we decide to call it. And then the funds would be remitted by legislation to the respective agencies, NHT, NIS, HART, et cetera. And if we
I saw some people commenting on that point where you said that you want to consolidate all the deductions into one deduction. Some people were saying that's how you hide things. They want to be able to see exactly where their money is going.
Well, there are two sides to the story. The first side is that it introduces a lot of complexity. We have four deductions already. To add a fifth one would mean that, especially for small businesses, for your business, Kalila, I mean, for, you know, businesses that employ fewer than 20 people or fewer than 10 people, it just, the complexity is just not worth it. And what you'll find is that people with additional of another Saturday reduction, you know, the incentive for informality will grow. So by legislation, it would be clear that a certain amount must go to the respective entities, that, you know, law has to be observed. And what if we do it that way, the advantages that by removing sort of thresholds and streamlining, we could be in a position to introduce unemployment insurance in a way that, you know, for 90 to 95% of persons, it's not an additional, you know, there's no more to be deducted. And that's what you call efficiency and productivity. One of the things, you know, Kalila, that people don't sort of fully recognize up front is that for the four different statutory deductions that we have completely different regimes for each of them. You know, they differ in the segment of employment income that is open to taxation, right, or open to deduction. Some of them have exemptions before you can deduct. Then they have different thresholds. So you need a computer program, literally, to work
tell
out
me about it.
Deductions today.
Tell me about it. Today is the 26th. So yesterday I had payroll. Yesterday I had payroll to do, and for the first time, I had to do it myself. Yes. I literally have the tab open here trying to figure out, okay, so education is 3% for employer and 2.25 employee. And then this one is that, and they're all different.
Not only the rates are different, but the threshold that it applies to, they differ from each of them, right? Some of them are up to this amount, some of them are up to that amount. And some of them exempt certain income from the deduction. So literally, to do it properly, you need a computer program. I mean, mm-hmm. You know, so what we want to do is to simplify the system. And that we have found that when you simplify the system, formality improves. When we got rid of the minimum business tax and the asset tax for non-financial businesses, company registrations went through the roof, and they continue to set new records. So it's from that experience that what we want to do ideally is to consolidate the social taxes. One tax. You have income tax above the threshold of 25%, and you have another one above another threshold at 30%, and then you have one statutory reduction of X percent. Simple. That will put small business or micro business on even playing field with large businesses. For large businesses, it doesn't really matter. It doesn't make a difference. Because they have the people, they have the administration, they have the staff, they have the enterprise systems. They can afford SAP and all these complicated systems. They can deal with the complexity. But if we want Jamaica to grow and prosper, we need it to be easy for micro businesses to simply to be compliant. Right? And that would be the motivation behind that. But it's very, very challenging to achieve. I don't want to underestimate it or to say it's easy to achieve that goal of a. You know, as I said, you know, it's not a new idea. That idea has been around for some time, and it has been pursued by others, and it has not yet been achieved.
I think employers will support you on that. I don't know about employees, which is the majority of the population, whether they will go for it, but we'll see. It just takes public sensitization.
What's in it for employees is that you can get another, for most employees, right? For 95% of employees, you can get another benefit without paying any more. How about that? But to get it, we're going to have to consolidate. If you want to pay more, we can keep it separate, have five separate deductions. Yeah, but you're going to pay more.
Okay. The next thing that has received a lot of attention is this reverse tax credit. So Sean says, Mr. Clark, can you please explain how the reverse tax credit will work and how can someone apply for it? Will there be a campaign to educate Jamaicans on how to get it?
Right. Thank you for that question. Let me ask the last question first. Absolutely. There will be a public education campaign to explain how it works, how to get it, what to do if you have problems. And we will not roll it out until that public education campaign has had the chance for majority of Jamaicans who are in the target group to see or to participate in a public education. The reverse income tax credit is a very simple proposition. we propose that every individual who earns under $3 million or $3 million and under in the 2023 year, who is also filing or paying or having deducted from their salaries contributions to NHT, to NIS, and to EdTax, that those persons will receive on application a grant of $20,000 from the government of Jamaica. It's a revolutionary concept in that it is providing a benefit in to persons you know, who there's no rhyme or reason, right? And what it aims to do, it recognizes the distribution of income in society, and it's sending a signal, right? This policy sends a signal that this is something, it's important to us that those at the bottom of the ladder who are contributing to the system, who have NHT, NIS, and EdTax deducted from their pay, that we hear you, we see you, and we understand that times are challenging, and here is a grant from the government of Jamaica. There's a concept, you know, reverse income tax credits are not new. They exist in other countries. And we will be doing this on a one-off basis this year to provide, you know, a modest amount of relief to Jamaicans. And you have to remember that we have 570,000 Jamaicans who earn below the income tax threshold, and 450,000, I'm sorry, who earn 570,000 who earn less than 3 million, and 450,000 whose incomes, as declared to the Tax Administration Jamaica, is less than $1.5 million. And it includes hundreds of thousands of persons at minimum wage or just above minimum wage, for whom a $20,000 check, no question asked, or $20,000 cash, no questions asked, will be quite meaningful.
So I heard the opposition's take on the reverse tax credit, part of it being that, well, everybody should get it, meaning because the conditionality surrounding your ability to qualify for the reverse tax credit is that your taxes for 2023 are paid up. But what about those people whose employer didn't pay over their taxes? And I heard your response today as well, saying, oh, well, those people, they're already getting more because their employer isn't paying the taxes. But that doesn't apply to everyone, Minister Clark, because there are employers who deduct the taxes from your salary, but don't pay it over to TAJ. So you get a pay slip saying that the taxes are have been taken out, but it hasn't been paid over. So those employees are not receiving more than other employees in similar roles.
All right, so Camino, Kalila, one thing in policymaking is that the exceptions don't make the rule, okay? Exceptions don't make the rule.
I don't know that that's a,
let's separate.
I don't know if I would qualify that as an exception because there are a lot of people who fall in that basket.
It's all relative to numbers. So let's separate working Jamaicans into two brackets. One bracket consists of persons who are, from whom statutory deductions are taken from their salary, or who voluntarily, because they're self-employed, they remit statutory deductions to the tax agencies. These are people from whom 2% has been deducted from NHT, 2% has been deducted from NIS, and 3% has been deducted from, 2% from NHT, 2% from education tax, and 3% from NIS. That's 7% that is leaving their salaries. What we're saying is that for people from whom 7% is leaving their salaries for their own benefit, right? Because NIS is a benefit, NHT is a benefit, but nonetheless is leaving their salaries, we're saying, look, we're going to give you a cash grant of $20,000. Now, as compared to the other bracket, a huge bracket of persons who are earning income, but who are not having 7% deducted from their salaries, It's only fair that if we're given a $20,000 grant, it goes to the persons from whom 7% has been deducted. The $20,000 is far less than the 7%. Far less. So for those from who are not contributing and from whom the deductions are not being made, they're better off anyway. Yeah, they have more of their income that they keep. So
I'm not following you on this point, because I thought the deduction was made. I thought I was paying over these taxes because my employer took it from my salary, but they never paid it over to me.
Right. So
it's not my fault that I'm not up to date on my taxes, because the employer is supposed to be making that payment on my behalf.
Understood. I'm getting there. I'm dealing with a large group of taxpayers first, right? The large groups consist of those who are in the system and contributing, right? Hundreds of thousands, almost 600,000 people in that bracket. And then there are hundreds of thousands of people who are not contributing. I'm making a distinction between those two groups and saying that one of those groups is 7% better off. And I'm justifying that the group that is 7% worse off, because they're compliant, they are deserving of the helping hand from the government. Now, there is, in the context of the employed labor force, there is a small number. I'm not saying it's small absolute, but it's small relative to the number of employed. There is a group of persons who are working for employers who are being fraudulent. There's no other way to describe it. They're being fraudulent. They're deducting from their employees and not paying it over. The remedy there, Kalila, is for them to be reported and taken to court, and for penalties to be applied, and for them to be forced by the court to pay over the funds. That is the recourse for that group of employers who, as you point out, have a deleterious effect on their employees. Forget the reverse income tax credit, Kalila. Think about their qualification for NHT. Think about their qualification for NIS.
Mm-hmm. You're talking about why I brought it up, because we always hear these stories about people saying, I went to NHT to apply for my benefit, and at that point, my employer never paid it.
So the key, it's much bigger than a reverse income tax credit. $20,000 is nothing compared to the opportunity to get a pension from NIS or to get a grant from the NHT. So we have a much bigger problem here. And the remedy for that problem is for employees, when they become aware, to report those employers to the authorities. Yeah. Once those employers are reported to the authorities, action can be taken and those employers can be held to account.
But you also have employers who have filed and they're just late. And they are incurring penalties and interest, but, you know, it is what it is sometimes. You know, you're late with the payment.
I would say, but I mean, based on the data that we have, Kalila, the persons who fall into those categories are the very, very small minority compared with the number who are in. That's just a fact. And, you know, in making policy, as I said, we can't dwell on the exceptions. And by exceptions, I mean people who fall outside of the norm, especially when those are, you know, in the minority. I'm not here including as a minority the large group of people who are decidedly in the informal system, right? I've already conceded as a large group, and that changing that will take time. But those people are better off by 7%. So I'm not worried about those. For the people that you're talking about, people who are late in filing, well, look, you know, we live in a country of rules and laws, and, you know, we are you got to be on time. There are nearly 600,000 persons who are on time, and, you know, they deserve to get the benefit.
Mm. All right. So we have a lot of comments on that one. Kevin says it's your fault. You should follow up with your employer to make sure that your tax is properly submitted. And I think this initiative is going to compel many employees to, when they apply, they're going to find out. And so it's probably going to improve compliance in that regard.
Employees badgering their employers is the best way to get this resolved. And look, the government wants the number of persons on the statutory, you know, deduction roles to increase, because these are statutory deductions are, you know, are not taxes, they're benefits, right? Well, certainly for NIS and NHT, you get a benefit, or there's a benefit that is, you know, available. So, and it's a part of our social security system. So we want more persons who are employed to be in the position where they're making their deductions. And you know what, Kalila, with the approach that we have taken, we have seen a gradual increase in formalization. I don't have the exact numbers here, but I do know that at least certainly at the beginning of the administration, the number of persons, you know, in the formal system were in the region of 500,000 plus, right? I don't know, 500,000, 520,000, 530,000, somewhere in that region. And today, the number of people in the formal system is 640,000. And I believe that if we continue with this kind of approach over time, you're going to see that number, you know, going up. And if we make the process more simple, part of the problem, the structural problem that keeps people out, is that it is too difficult to calculate and pay four separate deductions calculated very, very differently on different bases with different thresholds at the same time, right? To four different agencies. That is what is keeping people out of the formal system. And it is incumbent upon us to solve that structural challenge by allowing people just to pay one time, one amount. It becomes very, very simple.
Yeah, another major point from the presentation was about the removal of GCT from imported raw food stuff. We've heard a lot of discussion about that over the past couple of weeks. We have a question here. This person says he's a farmer. The GCT that we pay on farm product is killing us. Why not remove GCT off all farm products?
Right. So taxes like GCT, which are value-added taxes, right, which you are not net taxes, right? The net tax is the difference between your input VAT, your input GCT, and your output GCT. The country works best when GCT is basically applied everywhere, yeah? And we don't have so many exemptions. Jamaica went through a tough time fiscally, and we lost a lot. And one of the reforms that we had to do to get back to where we were was to broaden the GCT net. Now that Jamaica is doing a little better, reversing that would be a sure sign that, you know, yeah, that is problematic, right? Because there's no stopping. You know, there's a lot of organized interest groups would want GCT removed from their favorite thing. Believe me, as Minister of Finance and Public Service, I get suggestions like the one that you've mentioned multiple times from multiple groups. And once you start taking GCT off, you're going to be rolling it off of everything. Yeah. And the revenues are going to be cannibalized and eroded. And before you know it, you know, we're running massive deficits on the basis of consumption, running up our debt again. So it's just not sustainable to do that. On GCT on raw foods, you know, it's very, very unfortunate. And, you know, the fact that it falls to me to do it, I regret. I wish it weren't the case. But it's a simple matter from the point of view of what needs to happen. Article 3 of the General Agreement on Trade and Tariffs, GATT, is explicitly clear that internal taxes like GCT cannot be applied on goods coming into the country if they're not applied on those goods originating in that country. It's crystal clear. In 2012, the government needed to raise revenues, and they delivered a tax package of $19 billion in June of 2012, which annualized was $23 billion, or 1.8% of GDP. In that tax package was a broadening of the GCT net to levy GCT on raw foods, on all raw foods, imported and domestic. From 1991 up until that time, there was no GCT on raw foods, whether domestic or imported. So 2012, they make and they in a parliamentary speech, GCT is going on all raw foods, imported and domestic. There's a backlash, and the government removes GCT from domestic raw foods. Yeah? Not for protection, but for they can't afford to give up all of it, so they give up the domestic side. And play a game of what we call catch me if you can. Right? It was a violation then, but who's going to catch me, so to speak? Yeah? CARICOM wrote in 2014 and said, wait a minute, what you're doing here, I'm going to say wrote, they contacted the government. What you're doing here breaks international trade rules, and you're not allowed to do it. So what, you know what the government did in 2014? They had to put to remove the GCT from foreign goods that originate in CARICOM. Fast forward, so catch me if you can, the government was caught. Fast forward to 2023, the WTO visits Jamaica, and they make, this is obviously long after 2012, everybody's forgotten about it. They visit Jamaica and they make the observation that Jamaica is violating, breaching a sacrosanct principle that Jamaica is committed to. I mean, it's a bright line, black and white issue. You're not allowed to charge GCT differentially. You can charge duty, you can charge additional stamp duty, but you're not allowed to charge GCT on foreign goods and not charge them on the same goods produced locally. So when the WTA, what's our obligation? I mean, we are a law-abiding country. We are a country that a lot of people stand up and say, you must abide by international treaties. You must obey international law. This is not a negotiable aspect of the WTO arrangements. This is in the foundation principles. So we have no choice in the matter, Kalila. Either we put GCT on locally produced raw foods, or we take GCT off of foreign imported raw foods. Yeah. Now, bear in mind, you know, that the protection mechanisms are in the duties and additional stamp duties.
Right. I was just going to ask you about that, because I heard you saying today that we could make up for it by increasing stamp duty, customs duties.
Yeah. Yeah.
But so, that takes some time, because it's a lot of paperwork. Yes. Really.
The first thing to acknowledge is that I've made an announcement of the change in the GCT regime. I've not brought the bill to Parliament yet. I've not passed the amendment. We can determine the time, the exact time in which it's done, but it has to be done. Yeah. And what I was saying today is that certainly for goods like tomato, for cabbage, for carrot, we have duties of 100% and we have additional stamp duty of 80%. Now, the way those work, Kalila, and for your viewers, is that they are cumulative, they are compounded. So something costs a dollar. Or let's say something costs $10, the duty is 100%. Yeah? So that's the good now costs $10 plus $10, $20. And then you apply the 80%, which is 16. So you go to 36. So it goes from 10 to 36, 260% protection for tomatoes, for cabbage, and for carrots. And there are other duty amounts and additional stamp duty for other items. And what I said today is that we'll convene the required stakeholder group to look at additional stamp duty, to look at and decide what we are going to do. One thing to realize, though, is that there's a maximum that we can apply. And the maximum in Jamaica for a lot of goods is 80% additional stamp duty. And how the WTO works, and anybody can check this for themselves, right? There's a schedule of maximum additional duties that Jamaica, that's a part of our agreement with the WTO. And we can't go above those maximum, right? And to change those maximum would be a negotiating process. And Article 28 in my presentation, I erroneously said 23, but Article 28 of GATT of the lays out. Or sorry, it might be the WTO, check my speech, but it's Article 28, provides the mechanism through which negotiation happens. And I have a flow chart of it. It make your head hurt. It's a process that will take, for a small country like Jamaica, would take years and lots of money with high-priced lawyers. But what is more important is that Article 28 sets out that when you come into a negotiating process to change anything you've committed to, be prepared to give something up. That's in the article of negotiation. Yeah, you're gonna have to give something up. So, you know, but before we even get there, Kalila, as I said, the maximum of 80%, there are a lot of good that we're below 80% on. And we'll have that stakeholder group and we'll make a decision on what to do. Obviously, there are multiple considerations. One consideration is the price of food in Jamaica, right? And why should, you know, things that are good for you cost so much, right? So we have to bear all perspectives in mind, and that multi-stakeholder group will make proposals that I can consider. And what we'll do is try to time those. It may not be possible to time them exactly, but certainly that is the policy intent.
Going back to the reverse tax credit, we have a question from Dr. Scar, who wants to know, can pensioners apply for that?
Absolutely. Anybody with income less than $3 million for the year.
Oren wants to know, will the unemployment insurance be a mandatory deduction from the employee, or will it be paid solely by the employer?
Oh, that's a good question. I mean, I think it's fair that it would be split, right? That I said it would cost 0.8 to 1.5, and it needs to be split between employer and employee. You know, both would be vested. But as I said, Kalila, and just to remind the person who asked that question, our goal, if we're successful, is to consolidate the social statutory deductions, and therefore the headline rate doesn't change for the vast majority of people. If we're not able to do that, then it would be an additional charge to employer and employee, but it would be, you know, obviously a contribution. I mean, it would be, you know, it's a benefit, right? It's a benefit if you are somehow made, you know, unemployed.
Sean says, are you concerned about the effects the increase in minimum wage and tax threshold will have on inflation?
That's a very good question. And those are the kind of the debates that, you know, I'd like to have. We have seen that prior rounds of adjustment to the minimum wage have had minimal impact on inflation for a variety of reasons. Now, that's not to say that you can continue to increase the minimum wage and it not affect inflation. There comes a point where it could have an impact. I don't know that we're there yet, just because of, you know, adding sort of $2,000 a week more, the purchasing power. Yeah, I just don't, the analysis shows, Kalila, certainly the analysis for the previous round shows that the impact on inflation compared to other factors is minimal. Yeah. But, you know, as we get closer to the target range, any little deviation hurts, right? When you're at 7%, you know, if you say something is going to have a 0.2% impact, not a big deal. But if you're at 6%, a 0.2% impact makes all the difference between being inside the target range and out. So I say it with that advisement. So I don't have the precise number on me here, but my view is that the impact there will be an impact, but I don't know that the impact will be a major impact.
Follow up to that comes from Iron Lady. Mr. Clark, on what economic principle did you base the Jamaica minimum wage increase peg on? Was it Jamaica's inflation or just a number?
Oh, good question. So, Kalila, the minimum wage was $13,000, and it was increased to $15,000, which is an increase of 15%. One of the considerations that drove that change was the policy commitment that at some point in the future to harmonize the minimum wage rates for security guards and for non-security guards. You are aware that up until today, we have had differential minimum wage rates for security guards as opposed to people who are not security guards. And that has been because we had this arrangement where most security guards were hired on contract. Yeah. And I was chairman of the NHT, and with the prime minister's support, I approved of the NHT taking the matter of security guards as contract employees to court. Previous governments did not allow those court actions to go through. That is a fact that can be substantiated with documentation. With the support of the prime minister, as chairman of the NHT, you know, I supported that court case, and the court ruled that security guards ought to be employees. Now, once you make security guards employees, there's no need for a differential in the minimum wage rate for security guards and for persons who are not security guards. Let me just say something differently. For prior administrations, what I do know is that the NHT was certainly not encouraged to pursue the court cases. When I say with documentation, that's what I mean. That verbal evidence exists that, you know, just didn't support it or thought it was an inopportune time. We allowed it to go through. So the policy commitment that was at some point in the future, we're going to harmonize the tax rates for security guards and for persons who are not security guards. And given that for the first time, when we're setting a new minimum wage, security guards are now seen as employees, it made sense for this to be the time for that harmonization to happen. But we wanted to give security guards an increase, right? They were at 14,000, other minimum wage earners were at 13,000. So the natural position in terms of a, you know, whole number was to land at 15,000. I hope that's a bit of a long answer, but I hope you understand. So to say it quickly, the situation before, we had 13,000 for minimum wage earners who are not security guards, 14,000 for security guards. We wanted to harmonize it, the next whole number. But we also, not only harmonize it, we want to give security guards an increase as well. Harmonizing at 14,000 would mean security guards would not have gotten an increase. The next whole number is 15,000. We'll move everything up to 15,000. Obviously, we checked the increase, made sure it was higher than inflation. That box was ticked as well, and so settled on that number.
You know, I always wondered why there were two different rates for security guards versus everybody else for minimum wage. So thanks for clarifying why that is and why they are not.
Security guards were treated as contract employees and therefore, didn't get certain benefits, right? Didn't get certain benefits. So we had to factor that into the rate to make sure that when you factor in those things, they ended up at the same number, right? They weren't entitled to, you know, the same benefits. I think some of them are holiday and others. So this was the fix that Jamaica came up with to have this differential rate in minimum wage or differential levels in minimum wage rates.
Before you go, Minister, I want to ask you about something that was my major gripe with the presentations from both yourself and the Prime Minister. I didn't hear much for entrepreneurs and the business community in general. I'm talking things like tax incentives, grants, access to capital. When you are dealing with a group of people, entrepreneurs, business owners, who employ the majority of people in Jamaica, especially small businesses, why nothing significant for them?
Yeah, so, you know, the truth is, Kalila, we have to certainly rotate, and you'll see in this budget, we provided benefits for large segments of the population, which is important, right? Because people, you know, have to see that these reforms are working for them. We'd have started government providing benefits on the business side, and those worked out well because we saw the dramatic improvement in certainly in construction and in other sectors, tourism and BPO and so forth. Having said that, there's a lot of government programs directed towards business. Today, we have, I believe, if you were to add it all up, the number is close to $10 billion of private equity, venture capital financing that has been catalyzed by government contributions, right? So the government has co-sponsored or sponsored several of these funds which have had the have we have done it on the basis that they go out and raise additional funds. And I believe if you add it up, certainly it's closer to 10 billion than it is to five in terms of equity financing that's available. We also, I didn't speak about it, but we do have, you know, World Bank and IDB financing through the Development Bank of Jamaica that continues, if I'm not mistaken. So we have existing programs continuing, but I agree that with the with one or two possible exceptions, you know, we didn't have anything big headline new. But just, Khalilah, just bear in mind that, you know, it's a big country, and in any one budget, reaching every single group is challenging, and we have to make choices year to year. And I would say that we have, you know, had huge support for the business community over the period of this administration, and that is going to continue.
So next time.
Yes. Yes. We did reduce the corporate income tax rate for independent power producers. I mean, I know you're not one, but we did, you know.
That's like 4-5 businesses out of thousands.
They're important businesses. They produce energy on a renewable basis, and we want them to continue to grow. And we have a huge RFP that's out for, what is it? Is it 200 megawatts or thereabouts? And we want to incentivize to get good bids at low prices. So reduce the tax rate there. But I agree in general that, you know, this year, the budget definitely played more of a focus to the you know, working people in Jamaica who are critically important, Khalilah, to keep the system going.
Is that because the election is coming up?
I mean, election is not constitutionally due until September of 2025. But you would have seen, if you examined our policies over the past few years, that there is a rotation, right? That we are principled and deliberate about sharing the gains of economic recovery and economic stability with all segments of the Jamaican society. It doesn't come all at the same time. Public sector employees would have gone through 2016, 2017, 2018, 2019, 2020, 2021, looking at the rest of Jamaica and the stuff that we're doing there. Yeah, but their time came in 2022, 2023, and 2024, and they got $200 billion in additional allocation for public sector compensation. So I'm saying that to say that it's not possible to do all things for everybody at the same time in the same year. But I think if you examine our record from 2016, you'll see that we are fair, and that over that time period, all demographic groups have been able to benefit from the advances that we're making in economic stability and in sustainable and in the fruits of sustainable policies.
I want to thank you so much for joining us this evening, Minister Clark. Hope you get some rest now.
Yeah, bye. I definitely need it. Thank you, Khalilah.
All right. And to our viewers, so you know we went way over time, but it was necessary, and we do that from time to time when we have big issues like these to discuss. To our viewers, now it's time for our poll question. And tonight's poll question you can take on the community tab of our YouTube channel or on Twitter, or you can leave your comments here in the comments section as well. What were your highlights? I feel like I should say overall. The question here says, what were your highlights from Prime Minister Andrew Holness's budget presentation, which was last Thursday, but we had Minister Clark going again today. But since we did the last Taking Stock and we spoke about this, we didn't get any reaction from you, the viewers, to the PM's presentation. So what were your highlights from that? A, NHT changes. B, minimum wage going up. C, HART will be free to attend. Other, leave a comment. Let me know, what were your highlights? NHT changes, minimum wage going up, HART will be free to attend, or other, leave a comment. And there are so many other things as well. Long, long, long list. PM spoke for 5 hours. Must be a record. I don't know. It was a long one, though. And we do have other videos coming up you know, breaking down all the changes. So I have an NHT video coming up. We did JUTC, I think, yesterday, and we have further recap videos coming up throughout the rest of the week, already recorded, already scheduled, already planned. So make sure you're on the newsletter, KalilaReynolds.com/newsletter, so you don't miss any of these breakdowns. So take that poll on Twitter or on the community tab of this YouTube channel. You can also leave your comments in the chat. And remember to hit the like button. Up next, we've got your market recap, and the analysts are standing by. Hey, moneymakers, join the KRM fam with our official merch. Get it now at KalilaReynolds.com. Let's get this money.
The JSE Combined Index was mostly flat last week. 125 stocks traded across the main and junior markets for the week ending Friday, March 22, 2024. 48 made gains, 58 lost value, and 19 stayed the same. 134 million shares changed hands on the Jamaican dollar market, valued at $397 million. Wigton was last week's most traded stock. It took up 25% of market volume, with 34 million shares trading. The stock lost 2 cents to open the new week at $1.10. One Great Studio traded the second highest. The stock lost 13 cents to open Monday at 86 cents. The stock was also the week's third biggest loser. And TransJamaican rounded out last week's most traded, with 18 million shares changing hands. The stock lost 27 cents to open Monday at $3.22. Now let's see who had the biggest gains for the week. JMMB 7% VRJMD CR preference shares was the market's biggest gainer, up 42% last week. The stock opened Monday at $3.17. Cygnus Real Estate Finance USD was the week's second biggest gain, up 22%, and 138 Student Living Variable Preference was up almost 18% to close the week at $218.03. On the losing side now, the Lab was the week's biggest loser. The stock lost 14% open Monday at $1.54. Cygnus Credit Investments USD had the second biggest dip. The stock lost 13% open the new week at $0.08. Over on the Trinidad and Tobago Stock Exchange, the composite index was mostly flat last week. Grace Kennedy was the most traded stock. The stock lost 5 cents to open Monday at $3.90 TT. Prestige Holdings was the biggest gain of the week. The stock was up 8% to start the week at $12 TT. And on the losing side, One Caribbean Media fell almost 8% open Monday at $3.48 TT. Over in the US, the Dow Jones, S&P 500, and NASDAQ were all up around 2% last week. Over at the pumps, gas prices went up by $3.06 last week, while diesel prices climbed $4.50. In foreign exchange, it took an average $154.58 Jamaican to purchase $1 last Friday. That's 32 cents less than the week before. Meanwhile, it took an average $115.95 Jamaican to purchase $1. One British pound cost on average $197.91 Jamaican. Finally, you could buy €1 for $168.74 Jamaican on average. And on the crypto markets, Bitcoin prices were down 1.5% over the past 5 days, trading at $66,848 US on Monday, while Ethereum prices were down 2%, trading at $3,445 US on Monday.
Disclaimer: this is not intended as financial advice. Please consult a licensed financial advisor before making investment decisions.
Welcome back. Welcome back. Let me take a few of your comments, Sabe, and reminding you guys, if you appreciate what Kalila is doing for us, let's press the like button. Appreciate you for reminding our viewers of that. Prosperity. Well, the name should tell you. The Prosperity says, if the JLP is given the opportunity for another term, all Jamaicans will become millionaires. In JMD, most of us are. In Jamaican dollars, most people I would say earn more than a million a year, JMD terms. Do you mean USD? That would be nice. Daniels and Mr. Clark basically said the Jamaican people pressured us, so we have to listen. Business owners have to wait. Chevane said, LOL. Cal said, so next time. Foxyan says, highlights for me personally was that me I go get $4,166 back in my pocket every month. Andrew says, my highlight was a red card. All right. And we have Jay Light saying, you're asking really good questions for everyone watching. Remember to like and subscribe. Thank you guys so much for your feedback. It's time now for the analyst. I'm joined by business writer at the Jamaica Observer, David Rose, and personal finance and business analyst, Yuni Abdul. Welcome, David. Welcome, Yuni.
Night, Kalila.
Good night.
Well, it has been months since I've been trying to get you on the show, Yuni. So let me just let the viewers know that Yuni is from Guyana, and you have a TikTok page. That's how I found you. And you cover, you know, topics in Guyana. So you do what I do for the Guyanese market. What's your handle on TikTok?
My name, right? So Yuni.Abdul.
And that's Y-O-U-N-I.
Y-O-U-N-I dot A-B-D-U-L. Yes.
Okay. So last time we talked with you, well, a lot has happened since the last time we spoke with you. I saw you listening keenly to the finance minister's presentation because you guys just had a big budget presentation as well. Yes. So give us an update on how things are going in Guyana right now.
All right. Well, I know one of the things you love to speak about with regards to Guyana is the oil. So I'll start off there. But I'll just give an asterisk and say, you know, Guyana is not only oil, right? It's uplifting all the other sectors. All right, so just to get into that, right, we are predicting a GDP growth of 34.3%, all right, with non-oil growth being 11.9%, all right. The Natural Resource Fund shows that we have about 442 billion Guyana dollars inside. And just for context, right, I think one Jamaican dollar is 1.3 Guyana dollars, right? So just to let you know how much is in that pot, right, in a natural resource fund, and all that has been from oil, right, either through royalties or profit sharing. All right, and so just to add on to that, so since about 2019, Guyana has been receiving about 1 billion US per year into the natural resource fund, and we have been every budget, right, we've been passing legislation to get money withdrawn from that, and we've been using it. One thing I'd like to note, right, Guyana is also signing on to quite a lot of loans from, you know, IDB, World Bank, and these things. And I suppose that's because our credit worthiness has gone up in the wake of these new, this big influx of cash coming in from the Natural Resource Fund, which comes from the oil. You know, one thing that's peripheral to the oil sector is the local content. All right. All these companies in Guyana operating, you know, like ExxonMobil and all the tier one suppliers to ExxonMobil and all the other companies, Hess, CNOOC, which is the Chinese companies. All right. Guyana has passed. I think one of the major things that has come up since we last spoke is this thorny issue of local content, right, which is a bit of a protectionist legislation to ensure that Guyanese companies that supply those sectors are able to benefit, right? So we have protected percentages by which these companies must pull, all right, from the Guyanese market to get things done, right, rather than rely on their overseas suppliers of things. So that's one thing that's been helping to boost the economy, right, as a spin-off or as a direct spin-off from oil and gas activities, all right? What more can I say about the oil? One thing I wanted to contextualize is our oil production. All right. Of course, since we started in 2019, our monthly and yearly oil production just keeps going up and up and up. But I don't think anybody has really given it context, because when you hear things like 100,000 barrels, 500,000 barrels, 600,000 barrels per day, I mean, as an absolute value, right? Fine. But how does that stack up comparatively? And I think that's one of the things I wanted to just put out here, right? So just for context, all right? Again, currently Guyana has about 11 billion barrels of oil proven, right? And we're currently pumping about 600,000 barrels per day, right? In 2027, Guyana will be pumping 1.3 million barrels of oil per day, right? Now, Brazil is about 2.8 million barrels per day. Russia is 11 million. China is 4 million barrels per day. India is 700,000 barrels per day. And Saudi Arabia is 9 million barrels per day. So in 3 years from now, Guyana will be about 1.3 million barrels per day. So I think that context really helps to put into perspective, right? Like how major Guyana is, you know, in the last 5 years or so, you know, how we've risen to the top. You know, we're above Mexico, all right, which has access to the Gulf of Mexico and all those deep water activities and so that I just wanted to speak on that. All right, so that's about it for the oil. You mentioned the budget. We did pass.
Before you move on from the oil, well, it kind of connects to the budget because a lot of budget is being financed from this oil fund that you mentioned. Are the people feeling the impact of all of this?
You had the same question the last time, and I'm prepared for it. But I have a more philosophical perspective, right? Guyana has about 800,000 people, right? And if you ask every single person, they'll give you a different answer. What I can give you is my answer. And, you know, based on some, if, you know, you, Kalila, you're one of the persons that know me well in this world of finance here, right? I'm a financial absolutist. And this is one of the things I mentioned the last time that I was here, is that if you have boats in the dock, right, as the tide comes in, it's going to raise all the boats. But for you to get the benefit of the rising tide, you have to have a boat, all right? So you have to be, you know, a working member of society. You have to have a business, right? One of the other ways that you can get the benefit is to be part of a beneficiary of some of the social programs, which Guyana has the government that's in power now has a very statist ideology, right? So they've put a lot of social net programs in place. So you'll get benefits from there. But I always say, right, if you want to participate, you have to have a boat in the water, a business, or you got to be in the industry or some peripheral industry. So there are many ways that you can get benefit out of the activity that's going on. You know, one of the other ways that you can get benefit is just through, this will seem very rudimentary, but just simply existing in part of Guyana's economy. For example, if you spend $1 into Guyana's infrastructure, it generates $1.3 in economic output, all right, which the citizens can enjoy. But of course, all these things I'm seeing have a very political lens attached to it, all right? Because I don't know what the political climate is like in Jamaica, but as I think you and the rest of the world know, Guyana is a very spicy political place, right? You know, we're now in 2020. So like the answer to that question also has to do with how you perceive it politically. You know, the PPP government is in power, which has been traditionally supported by the Indian class, right? People who look like me, for example. I'm not saying I support the PPP. I'm not going to say who I support. But, you know, if you speak to people like them, they'll have positive things to say. If you speak to somebody who has a next political perspective, they're going to say Guyana is in the trenches. It's burning. Everything is on fire. So it's hard to answer that. But I just know from an economic standpoint, what is happening and maybe how some things can trickle down. I still do have some reservations as to how some of the things are being managed, but they're healthy reservations. And as a free thinker, all right, you know, for example, I was saying Guyana is signing on to quite a lot of loans, all right, but I guess that's part of our credit worthiness increasing, but I'm still very cautious of it and how we manage it. But I guess those in power probably, you know, have better view of the numbers, right?
So the last video I did on Guyana was about the budget, Guyana's first $1 trillion budget. And I got a lot of viewers from Guyana commenting on that. We had 330,000 views on that video. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the people who were commenting were saying, okay, they have all this money, but they're not paying teachers. And that kept coming up over and over. What's the issue going on with teachers?
Right. Again, teachers have traditionally, I mean, we make no bones about it, right? Traditionally, teachers in Guyana have been Yeah, I mean, like to be honest, like a bunch of other sectors. Some would say even the nurses are worse off, right? But teachers in general have always had a very strong unionization, right? That has agitated and pushed for increases in salary, particularly every time budget comes around. One thing I would like to mention: the head of the Guyana Teachers Union is Member of Parliament for the opposition party. So again, going back to the politics of it, and that's what you'll hear coming out buzzing, right, with this whole thing with the teachers. But politics aside, teachers, yes, they do deserve an increase in pay, right? But again, the economists or the financial person will ask, well, where is it going to come from? All right, and this is one of the things Nigel Clark was, that's his name, right? He was speaking about, if you dropped it, was a GCT, then all the other sectors are going to want the GCT drop. One of the things President Ali was mentioning is that he's just asking the teachers to be patient. In the meantime, I think the Ministry of Education in Guyana has put a lot of other non-financial provisions and even some financial provisions in place to buffer costs of living increases. And so I don't really have the details of that. But I think there was a negotiation between the Guyana teachers and the Ministry of Education where there was a 23 out of 28 point plan that has been accepted. So there is progress there, but again, there's a political element to this that I don't want to comment too strongly on, you know, but I think just like the nurses, they will get there at some point, I suppose.
How patient? Because I saw in the comments, they're saying most teachers make less than 100,000 Guyanese dollars a year. And guys, JMD is stronger than the Guyanese dollar right now. Yeah, so yeah. 100,000 it's worth even less in Guyana. So
actually, I'm not sure that most teachers make less than 100, because I know teacher trainees at the Cyril Potter College of Education, they're making 99,000 a month in stipend only. So I'm guessing once you've been qualified, it goes up. So, you know, frankly, I can't say where the numbers are if it is 100,000 now, but I just know a trainee makes 99. So I'm guessing a teacher would make more. Right. But the bottom line is, of course, it needs to increase. The president has said himself, yes, it will increase. One of the things he was talking about with, when he was saying how patient, or please be patient, in 2027, Guyana will have paid off quite a lot of the, there's something called cost recovery with these oil companies that they're doing. And by 2027, quite a lot of it will be paid off. So that will open the avenue for even more income to come into Guyana's pocket. And I think some of that is going to, you know, be filtered down to the nurses, the teachers, the doctors, that kind of stuff. So yeah, that's some of the medium term perspective on that when it's coming.
Yeah, I definitely need to visit your country soon and into some work over in Guyana.
No, it sounds like Jamaica is doing excellent.
Yeah, a couple comments. Iron Lady says, time for Jamaica business people to be in Guyana. I'm trying to buy property in Guyana. Guyana is the next Dubai. Tyrone says, what are the steps to a Jamaican Guyanese dual citizenship?
Well, I think one of the very popular Jamaican companies is already here, NCB Capital or something like that.
NCB is in Guyana.
Yeah, they opened the office here about a year and a half ago.
Yes, I remember hearing that indeed, NCB Cap. And then we had Prosperity saying JMD is higher than the Guyanese dollar, so Jamaicans can invest in Guyana and get a higher return. So some excitement over here, Uni.
Yes, yes.
Thanks for our Guyana update.
Yes.
So the last topic we got to talk about today is from David, and it's about First Caribbean. So speaking about Jamaica, speaking about Guyana, First Caribbean is ramping up its expansion plans across Jamaica and the region. So it's another regional story. David, tell us more.
Well, For one particular fact, you know, Mark St. Hill, who is the current, you know, First Caribbean CEO, you know, he said that while Guyana is this hot market everybody looking towards, he says they're relatively well banked. So if anybody says, is First Caribbean looking to Guyana, you got in the response. But in terms of them focusing on the remaining 10 core markets, they're planning to go pretty hard in Jamaica. So, you know, although Jamaica only makes up 8% of, you know, the revenue and even 8% of total assets for First Caribbean, they're planning to go pretty hard in Jamaica going forward. So, you know, they've approved a $25 million capital injection into the Jamaican subsidiary here which is about 4 billion Jamaican dollars, to help facilitate that growth expansion. And how does that capital injection work? So banks have particular requirements, and by giving them, or in this case, First Caribbean, the parent, giving its Jamaican subsidiary more capital, it allows them to be able to do potentially more loans and also, you know, consider other forms of business that they probably wouldn't have considered without the capital injection. So that's on the Jamaican front. You know, like, I've been getting a lot of First Caribbean ads in recent times, and, you know, in respect to the remaining core markets, they're planning to open a branch in San Fernando, that's in Trinidad. You know, they're currently benefiting pretty well in Bahamas and Cayman, where US dollar rates are. And, you know, they're still, you know, looking to introduce new features to the rest of the markets. So one thing I got to appreciate, you know, from the recent First Caribbean AGM was where they mentioned that in a couple of the markets, they have mobile check deposits. So but some of the viewers are probably in, you know, Europe or Canada or USA, you probably had mobile check deposits for years. And, you know, a perspective I got to appreciate, and I hope Dr. Clark is probably watching this program still, is where the Chief Information Officer, Mr. Essan Peters, highlighted that in the markets where they're able to facilitate mobile check deposits, there is the option, not option, in the legislation, there is the facilitation that allows for, you know, exchange of images and other matters regarding the settlement of checks. So as a result, what ended up happening is that persons are able to just take their phone, take a picture of their check, you know, sign and everything, and the money is processed and everything. You don't need to go in branch. So that's like kind of a bit of the highlight, you know, the high level perspective. And what we also seen, you know, if you've been traveling around Kingston or just, you know, seeing the different First Caribbean branches, that they've been rebranded to CIBC. So while, you know, I'm still referring to First Caribbean as that name at the moment, one should appreciate that although they rebranded, it was only until the shareholder meeting on the prior Friday where the name change was approved by shareholders. So First Caribbean is now going to be called CIBC Caribbean Bank Limited. And, you know, Mark Sintil also mentioned that this will also, you know, facilitate them getting better deals. Because, you know, for example, Bank of Nova Scotia in Canada, known with a trade name of Scotia Bank, you know, is the same kind of brand that you see with Scotia here in Jamaica. And, you know, throughout the rest of the region. First, well, CIBC, which is the parent company of First Caribbean International here in the region, they had this distinct separate brand here in the region that, you know, they tried to make grow on a standalone basis. And now with them, you know, aligning themselves with their parent, it gives them a little bit more brand recognition and, you know, potential investor confidence of firms that want to do business with them. So in Jamaica, they're the sixth largest, also the eighth commercial banks. And, you know, they're planning to say they're planning to expand. We need to see how that will go in terms of potentially from the loan side, the retail side. At the end of the day, to see, you know, the regional bank planning to expand more in the region is a good thing. And bringing some of these features to the market does benefit consumers. Because for you to just take a picture of your check and that is it, you'd have to go to an ATM and then insert and hopefully the machines and take a check and have issues. It's just a beautiful thing to hear. So, you know, that's just one major bank, you know, we're hearing updates on in recent times. You know, we've also seen where, you know, the new Bank of Nova Scotia CEO, Scott Thompson in Canada, has announced a new four-pillar strategy. We're hearing it now from, you know, Scotia Group Jamaica and, you know, Scotia Bank Trinidad and Tobago. So let's see what, you know, these Canadian banks bring to the table in the Jamaican market and the rest of the Caribbean as well. And just as a fun thing I just remembered, Scotia Bank Ghana tried to sell their operations about 2 or 3 years ago to First Citizens in Trinidad. Ghana Central Bank denied that transaction.
Guyana Central Bank denied the transaction, you said?
Correct.
Yes.
Hey, you need to know what I'm talking about. No, so I remember seeing that transaction announced, and I'm like, wait, First Citizens isn't operating in Ghana. Like, how did the transaction just occur? So, you know, that transaction was denied. Not sure if Scotia tried to kind of swing to exit Guyana, but let us see.
Well, I think what the government here is trying to avoid is you know, a lack of diversity in terms of the types of banks, right? I mean, we have our normal indigenous banks like the Amara Bank and so forth, but Scotiabank is one of the banks we rely on heavily for wire transfers. All right. I know all the other banks can do wire transfers and have a foreign trade section, but I just, you know, I'm not sure on what basis the transaction was denied. I'm guessing maybe they want the other bank to operate independently for a while. Guyana, the powers that be, especially with regards to the banking industry, right? It's a very conservative, tight-knit group. All right. So market penetration is something very hard to achieve, much less you coming and swap out an ex-established player. All right. So I think from that kind of angle or that kind of sentiment, the transaction was blocked. I know that seems like a very subjective analysis, and it might be, but in terms of something objective or whatever, if they put out something else, I'm not sure. But I can tell you firsthand that the banking sector here is very, very tight knit. And in fact, that's one of the things President Ali was trying to. He actually had a meeting with the Banking Association in January, I believe. He's quite upset with how things are working here in Guyana. You know, some of the hoops you got to go through to get a bank account are more than the regulatory or some of the water is more than what compliance demands. All right.
Sound like
So
sound very familiar.
I remember Kalila had a show regarding this where something with the references in Jamaica, they dropped that, right? So I mean, the president is trying to break down some of those barriers, and then of course, you know, when a new company comes in, that is something they got to try and do with market penetration. But to go straight to an acquisition of Scotiabank, I think sort of caught them off guard. All right. And I think maybe the association had a role to play. Of course, I can't comment on that. All that is alleged, right? So yeah.
Look at that truthful discussion.
Alleged.
But before we finish off, Kalila, you know, it's end of quarter again. For persons who don't remember, this Friday and Monday are public holidays, so those are no trading days. What that means is Thursday, March 28 is the last day of trading for the quarter. And that means there's a time for persons to make money and for persons to also take some positions. I made some gains already, so let us see how the next 2 days play out.
All right. Thanks for the tip. Thank you so much, David. Thank you, Uni.
Thanks.
Thanks.
Awesome. So let's take our final break and we'll come back with more of your comments. I'm Kalila Reynolds, the Money General, and I'm on a mission to help you get better with money. Join me inside the Money Mission community where I'll teach you how to manage money, make more money, and annihilate bad debt. Click the link in the description to sign up for your basic or premium membership. Let's get this money. All right, welcome back. Let's take some final comments. I was just reading through some of them here. What do we have? KJ Martin wanted to know, are we serious about a train system for Kingston, Portmore, and Spanish Town? It's the biggest productivity booster. I heard Minister Clark addressing the train system during his closing presentation today. Suggestion coming from the opposition. Mike Henry was the one who's been proposing it for years and years and years. Mr. Multimodal, we used to call him reporting on Parliament. We'd love to see it happen. I think I heard Minister Clark say that once we get to 60% debt to GDP, that is an investment that we can look at. We're now at, don't let me give you a number. I think it's 80 something percent. So 60% is within reach. Imagine a few years ago, we were at 140%, 142%. Now 60% is within reach. Iron Lady says, why burden employers with unemployment scheme but raise the minimum wage so little? Shelly-Ann, keep the insurance separate. This is for the deduction for unemployment insurance. She says, keep the insurance separate. The public will know exactly how much they've contributed and what they would be entitled to if they become unemployed. Let's talk politics with Mr. Vega, says, knowing that the 300% parliamentarian increase is still hanging out there, will you bring a bill to the floor to increase the teachers and law enforcement officers' salaries? So they did increase teachers and law enforcement salaries, not by 300%, though. So there's that. Seban says, contract Money Media to carry out an education campaign. You know, there's so many comments on TikTok saying I got paid to do the videos for the budget series. I wish I got paid. So send that to Minister Clark. Contract Money Media to do the education campaign, because we for sure did not make any money producing that series. We did it for the public good. KJ Martin, Dr. Clark, when will we have legislation to attract VCs and private equity, so venture capital and private equity, to Jamaica's market and for international startups to come so we can have transfer like what Chile did? Okay. Oren said, real talk, they just need to visit NHT with their TRN and ask if the deductions are being paid over. What about the others? It's not just NHT. You have PAYE, education tax, NIS, I guess go to TAJ. I don't know. We need to find out, like, what is that process? If you found out from NHT that your deductions weren't paid over, chances are the other deductions also weren't paid over. How do you report that? What is the procedure? Devon says SVL is also in Guyana and wanted to know when is the next IPO. From what I'm hearing, possibly within the next month. I don't know if the timeline is still on track for that. We had a couple from IG. Nessa Patience in Peace said, I would love for it to be implemented and the public is properly educated beforehand. I think she was referring to the unemployment insurance. Yes, she was. Liana on Instagram also said, overtime policy for government employees. What's the latest on that? So we didn't get to ask all of the questions, obviously limited in time, but lots more questions for Minister Clark that we didn't get a chance to get to. But thank you guys so much for tuning in yet another week. That's it for this week's show. Make sure you like the video, subscribe to the channel, share with a friend, subscribe to the newsletter at KalilaReynolds.com/newsletter. We have a lot of stuff that we share via newsletter. Turn on the post notification so you can be the first to see everything when it drops this week. We have episode 4 of The Property Source, and it's all about buying a vacation home in Jamaica, whether you live abroad. And I know we have a lot of viewers who are abroad right now in the diaspora. You want a second home in Jamaica. Or if you live here, but you want a nice property on the North Coast or on Treasure Beach or somewhere, we're talking about buying a vacation home in Jamaica in episode 4 of The Property Source, powered by REMAX, that premieres on Thursday. We want to help people learn more about money so we can all get this money together. Follow me on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok at Kalila Ray. Remember, that's my only account. I have no backup accounts. So please report the scammers and the impersonators whenever you see them. So one thing I like about Twitter, they take them down. Because somebody showed me one yesterday. I reported it. They made me upload my ID and a selfie. And within less than 24 hours, they took it down. Same can't be said for TikTok, unfortunately. If you want to connect with the analysts this week, check the description box below for their contact information. And you can also visit our website, KalilaReynolds.com, for financial information you can use however you like it, watch, listen, or read. Now tell a friend about Taking Stock, because investing is the new sexy. So let's make it cool to talk about money. I'm Kalila Reynolds. Thanks for watching.
Let's get this money.